Hadassah is a well-known person in the Bible. In fact, there is even a book in the Old Testament named after her. But we typically do not know her by her Hebrew name, Hadassah, which means myrtle, but we know her by her Persian name, which means star. And I believe her Persian name gives a hint or a clue about her beauty, both outward and inward, which she used for the salvation of her people when they were about to be extinguished in their adopted nation. She reminds us that sometimes the right man for a job is a woman, because she was put into a position that no man could occupy. And while at first she hesitated, and indeed many other women may have hesitated, knowing that it would cost her life, or that it could cost her life, yet she eventually went against the rule of the king and embraced her fear. And God used her to save many people. During times of crisis, even today, God's people can read this 10-chapter book and see that God knows our struggles and is working to help us, but not normally in the ways that we expect. But we do discover that God works all things together for good to those who love God and to those who are called according to His purpose. Or I like the way Daniel spoke to King Nebuchadnezzar in Daniel chapter 4, because it really epitomizes what is going on in this book that I'm talking about, that I want to start a series on a little while for the next several weeks. But in Daniel 4, God used the prophet to show King Nebuchadnezzar that God does what is necessary to make the world see that He is the one who is running the show, and it is our job to submit to Him and follow Him. Right at the end of Daniel 4:25, Daniel said to King Nebuchadnezzar, "The Most High rules in the kingdom of men and gives it to whomever He chooses." The book of Esther is what we're going to be looking at. And one writer said that it shows an unfolding of the divine providence. He also pointed out that in the book of Esther, the unseen power is seen. The unseen power behind human affairs. And that ultimate just rewards are given to both the good and the evil. In the book of Esther, we see the prosperity of the wicked ending in adversity, and the adversity of the righteous ending in prosperity. There is what you might call a poetic justice that occurs in the book of Esther, and it's beautiful to see how it works out. The book of Esther shows that even the minutest matters can be woven by God's shuttle into the fabric of His design to make whatever He wants to make out of it. And yet, it's not a book of fatalism where you just have to leave things to go as they're going to go, but rather by resolve and by the action that we take, we can be workers together with God to make things happen. Although the name of God is never found in the book of Esther, as well as a whole host of other things that are typically found in other Bible books. The name of God is never once seen in the book of Esther. And yet, God's seeming absence in the book really shows what the book is all about. That there's a hidden hand operating in the affairs of men and women especially on the behalf of his people. The book of Esther shows God amid the shadows. You know, sometimes we are like Elijah. We want to see spectacular displays of God's power. Do you remember when Elijah was getting away from Jezebel and the persecution in Israel, and he's out by himself, and he sees some spectacular displays of God? An earthquake, a wind that was so strong it could tear rocks into pieces. But each time it would say God was not in the wind. He was not in the earthquake. He was not in the fire. And then there would be the still, small voice. That's where God was. So often God just doesn't work the way we think He should work. Have you noticed that? Sometimes we may think, well, where is He? Why can't I tell what He wants? What is it that I'm supposed to do? Why is He distant? Why doesn't He care? Is He preoccupied or something? Habakkuk was like that. The book of Habakkuk starts out with the prophet saying to God, and I'm paraphrasing this greatly, you know, what is wrong that all this evil is going on around my people and you're not doing anything about it? God responds, oh yes, I am doing something about it. And then when Habakkuk hears what God is doing about it, he says, no, wait a minute, I don't like that solution. He thought God was not present, and then God showed just how present He was, and Habakkuk then said, I don't like that either. Or how about the disciples in a boat with the Lord on the Sea of Galilee? And there's a horrible storm. Do you remember what they said to Him when He was sleeping? Do you not care? Carest thou not that we are perishing? And of course we know the Lord cared very much. We want to know, though, every way that God works, especially in our lives, in the lives of the people we love, in our local congregation, in our nation. But He's not always evident in the ways that we want Him to be evident. But He is there. And if you stay with Him, you will learn more about Him all the time. Carrie and I have been married 25 years. And I am still just discovering things about her, and she's still just discovering things about me. You would think after all these years, we would know each other perfectly. But it doesn't happen that way, even among humans. Well, what about God? Who are we to think, well, we've got Him all figured out, and we've got the world figured out, and our lives figured out. This is the way He ought to work. But you stay with Him, and you learn from experience. You know something? He was right all along. He always knew what He was doing. Sometimes we get baffled and we wonder where we're going, how we're going to make it, but God is with us. I read something this week about the book of Esther that I thought was really interesting. This author said, God never knows frustration. I guess I've always known that, but I've never really either heard it expressed that way, nor have I expressed it myself. God never knows frustration. The writer continued, He never has to scratch His head wondering what in the world He's going to do next with people like us or with the nations of this world. How often have you been confused? I don't know what to do. What do I do now? I've got several options here, and none of them seem good. God is never in that position. That's the God we worship. That is the God whom we adore. Again, the writer continued, He will have His way and He will not be frustrated. And if you think He has met His match with you, my friend, you are in for one backflip surprise. If necessary, He will bring you to nothing to get your attention. He will even crush you. If need be, as He did with Nebuchadnezzar, the king, which is what Daniel chapter 4 was all about that I referred to earlier. Because God and God alone is calling the shots. Now, I think that's a good way to summarize God, but it's also a good way to summarize the book of Esther. Somehow, God was able to take an orphaned girl, raised or reared by her cousin Mordecai, and take her from obscurity, put her into a tremendous position of influence, and work redemption for his people in ways that we probably never would have dreamed up ourselves if we were writing the story. Again, it's so interesting that there's many things missing from the book of Esther. Prayer is not mentioned, although if there ever seems to be a book of the Bible where you need to be emphasizing prayer and talking about it, my guess it would be Esther, but it's not there. The law of Moses is never alluded to. Prophecies of Christ are non-existent, although there are indirect predictions in the book. It has been said that the books of Ruth, Song of Solomon, Philemon, and 3 John have no predictions in them, or very little. But then I consulted what is called an encyclopedia of biblical prophecy, and it said this about Esther. Esther holds the distinction of being the least predictive volume contained in Scripture. In the course of its 10 chapters, 167 verses, it can boast of but one lone forecast, whose single verse thus constitutes 0.6% of the whole. Now, I would also add a couple more verses. I would add Esther 4:14, which we'll read a little bit later, as well as Esther 6:13. Although they are not inspired by the Holy Spirit, now the writing of the book was inspired, but when the people who were speaking there spoke, they were not inspired. They were simply giving their views of matters which were rooted in the way things actually happen in history. Esther is never quoted or even alluded to in the New Testament. Visions, angels, and other heavenly phenomena are never referred to directly. They don't seem to have any direct part in the story. And of course, again, God is the most prominent omission. The words evil and wickedness, righteousness and goodness are not found in the book either. Now, contrast all of that with the last book that I just took you through in a series of sermons, the book of Haggai. I'm taking you from one extreme to the other. The book of Haggai, probably more than any other book in the Bible, emphasizes this is God speaking 26 times in 38 verses. Now we're going to look at the other end of the spectrum where God appears to be totally absent from the book. What was God communicating to us when he included a book with no religious overtones among 65 other books that are just dripping with religion? Well, we'll see in this series. And although God's name is not mentioned, you still get the idea that he is very present in the book. Now, there's at least 5 difficulties in the book that I want to mention. I want to throw them out to you so you can struggle with them as I do. And I'm hoping you'll read the book of Esther before I start preaching through it next Sunday, Lord willing. And but I want you to struggle with these questions in the same way that I've been trying to struggle with them for many years. There are some things that both Esther and Mordecai do and don't do that are puzzling to me. But I hope as we move through the book, we can discover why these things are so. For example, number one, was the king divorced scripturally when he took on Esther as his wife? Now, that question may be totally moot in a time when polygamy was allowed by God. A man could be married to one woman at the same time that he was to another. And so whether he divorced one or not may not have even been a point to consider. A second question that I have is, why did Esther marry outside the faith? The law of Moses forbid it. And I wondered, how would Ezra, who was a contemporary, or at least pretty close to it, how would he respond to her marriage? But turn to Ezra chapter 9. I want to show you something here about his strong reaction When he found out some of his fellow Jews marrying outside of the Jewish religion. Watch what happens here. Excuse me. Ezra chapter 9. When these things were done, the leaders came to me saying, "The people of Israel and the priests and the Levites have not separated themselves from the peoples of the lands with respect to the abominations of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Jebusites, the Ammonites, the Moabites, the Egyptians, and the Amorites. For they have taken some of their daughters as wives for themselves and their sons, so that the holy seed is mixed with the peoples of those lands. Indeed, the hand of the leaders and rulers has been foremost in this trespass." So when I heard this, I tore my garment and my robe and plucked out some of the hair of my head and my beard and sat down astonished. Then everyone who trembled at the words of the God of Israel assembled to me because of the transgression of those who had been carried away captive, and I sat astonished until the evening sacrifice. Now go to the book of Nehemiah. See, Ezra, Nehemiah, Esther, they're all right there together, so this is easy tonight. Nehemiah had hardly any less repulsion to the same situation in Jerusalem when his contemporaries repeated this same prohibition. Nehemiah 13, starting at verse 23. He says, "In those days I also saw Jews who had married women of Ashdod, Ammon, and Moab. And half of their children spoke the language of Ashdod and could not speak the language of Judah, but spoke according to the language of one or the other people. So I contended with them and cursed them, struck some of them, and pulled out their hair." Ezra pulled out his own hair. Nehemiah's pulling out their hair. "And made them swear by God, saying, 'You shall not give your daughters as wives to their sons, nor take their daughters for your sons or yourselves.'" And then he says, "Did not Solomon, king of Israel, sin by these things?" Well, yes, he did. "Yet among many nations there was no king like him who was beloved of his God, and God made him king over all Israel." So in other words, as great as he was, as loved by God as he was, that man sinned and fell and was condemned by God when he did the same thing. "Nevertheless, pagan women caused even him to sin. Should we then hear of your doing all this great evil, transgressing against our God by marrying pagan women?" So my question is, where does Esther fit in all this? Another question that I have, and maybe this one isn't so difficult, but Queen Vashti, the queen before Esther, was a modest woman, but Esther used her beauty. What was the king wanting the queen to do exactly? And if you're not familiar with the story, if you don't even know what I'm alluding to, please read Esther and you'll know what I'm talking about. Beauty is indeed a gift from God, but like any gift, it can be exploited sinfully, or it can be used to the glory of God. Maybe just in what I said right there, that answers why Vashti would not fulfill the request of her husband when he wanted her to come out and display herself, or why Esther did use her beauty to become queen. And the last question that I have that I think is a difficulty is, why did Mordecai not stand or bow for Haman? Remember, that's where the conflict arises in the book. Haman's going through the town. He's by the king's gate. He sees Mordecai, and everyone else, either at the appropriate time, will either stand or bow for Haman, but Mordecai doesn't. Why not? Are we not supposed to give honor to those to whom honor is due? So we'll talk about those when we go through the book of Esther. The book of Esther is an absolutely beautiful book in the way it's written. My guess is that if you've not read the book yet, and because of what I'm saying here, you think, you know, I really need to read that book. You'll read chapter 1, you'll come into chapter 2, and you won't be able to stop. Why? There's something about the way it was written that draws you into the story. It uses certain literary techniques to get you to see the battle between good and evil, in particular between Mordecai, the cousin of Esther, and Haman, who was essentially the number 2 man in the kingdom at one point in the story. And you see the plot arising and how this conflict is growing and growing, and it eventually comes to a head. There's this beautiful and courageous woman. There's banqueting and carousing. There's a harem and an enslaved orphan. There's a villain. There's rescue. There's intrigue, suspense, moral choices, climax, and ultimately justice in the end. And as you read it, notice this, what you do. You're going to judge the characters. You're going to think to yourself, Haman is a wicked man. You're also going to say to yourself, King Ahasuerus is a foolish, impulsive man. You're going to look at Mordecai and Esther and think, you know, those are good and righteous people. Although, the writer of Esther never once says any of those things about any of those people. He never even alludes to those things. But when you read the story, that's going to be your conclusion. Try and figure out how the writer is doing that to your thinking. So we have suspense, there's surprises, there's ironies. And the suspense that's presented to us is drawn out just as long as possible, and then we see it end. For example, it's in chapter 3 where we learn about the evil plot of Haman. But it's not until chapters 8 and 9 that it's finally reversed. Right in the middle of that, at chapter 5, is where Esther finally has the courage to reveal the evil plot. So she goes to the king and says that she has a request. He's ready to give it to her on the spot. She says no. She's not ready to do it yet. She invites the king and Haman to a lunch the next day, if I remember correctly on that one. So they come to the lunch. Now the king wants to know, what's your request, Esther? You can have half the kingdom if you want it. And she still is not ready yet. She says, I've got another lunch that I want you to come to. So we're wondering, why is she taking so long? What is she doing here? And finally, the next day comes, and that's when she reveals the plot. One of the great ironies about the book of Esther is how there's two men, King Ahasuerus and Haman, who have plans for one man, Mordecai. Haman is determined to kill Mordecai. And at the same, and he's making plans for it, even building a gallows for him. But at the same time, the king is wondering, you know, Mordecai did something kind for me, and I've never repaid him. I don't know what to do for him. So while Haman is making his plans to kill Mordecai, he then comes together with the king, and the king says, Haman, what should I do for the man that I want to honor? And Haman, so filled with himself, is thinking, now, I mean, you know, I'm really, besides the king himself, I'm really the most fabulous person in the kingdom. Who else would the king want to honor besides me? So if you were looking to have some honor poured out upon you, you know, what would you be thinking? Well, that's what he does. You're drawn right into his thinking, and you think, oh, yes, okay, let's do this and that and this and that. And when he's all done, thinking this is what he's about ready to receive, the king says, now go do that for Mordecai. The Bible never says Haman was humiliated by that, but boy, you can sure see it in the story. As we are led through the story, for a while there, we're thinking to ourselves, the heroes of the story are Esther and Mordecai. They have to be. But at the point where things turn for the Jews, Esther and Mordecai are not there. It appears now, all of a sudden, they're not the heroes of the story. They're not involved. We get the idea that something else, or rather, someone else is orchestrating events. And I like the way this one author put it. And again, if you're familiar with the book of Esther, you'll know what's being referred to here. And if not, you'll know once you read it. The king, this author said, just happened to be sleepless that night. He happened to ask for the royal records to be read, the section read happened to be about Mordecai's good deed. Haman happened to be in the palace the next day. Haman happened to misread the king's intentions, etc. Things which Esther and Mordecai could not influence. So yes, they're a major part of the story, but really when you come down to it, Esther and Mordecai are just tools that somebody else is using to work in the story. So the story moves us from despair to hope, from disaster to triumph, from ending in victory and festivity, indicating that the story is somehow going to inspire me and encourage me and even along the way entertain me. It's going to uplift me. Things may be bad, but I can see that somehow there's someone working to right all wrongs. So that in the end, God works everything out for His people. Now, in conclusion, I'd like to say this. Have you ever known someone that it seems like they constantly refer to the Lord? Always thanking Him, always giving Him credit, and so on. Making you think to yourself, well, somehow I just don't feel adequate because I don't refer to the Lord as much as this person does. And I need to be more like that. Well, it's good for that person to be like that, but it's also true that God works in our lives silently, even if no mention is made of Him. This is what we will see in the book of Esther. Some people just can't figure out, why would God include a book like Esther in the Bible? The Reader's Digest, yes. But not a book in the Bible where God, angels and miracles, prophets, sacrifices, preaching, calls for repentance, God's condemnation, God's commendation, and all those things are absent. What's it doing in the Bible? But when you get down to it, the book is crying out to us that there is a God and He's working on behalf of His people. Again, I'd like to read to you from another author what he says about the book of Esther. He says, "And so we're off on an unusual journey. The road will take several twists and turns, but don't worry, we have not lost our way. We're simply following the leader, who has a way of keeping us wondering at times where we are going and why it seems so confusing on this journey called life." In other words, not just in Esther's life, but in our lives also. "But the good news is this. He knows what He is about. His way may not be as we expected, but it is the only way to go. And when you mix the power of an awesome God with the power of a godly woman, or man for that matter, you've got a winning combination." Now, the last thing I'd like to read to you is from Esther chapter 4. My opinion is that God is teaching us in the book of Esther what Esther finally learns here in Esther chapter 4. God is trying to get each of us in our lives down to what Esther realized, to where we make this confession and we resign ourselves to letting Him run things. When Mordecai told Esther, "Here's what you need to do to keep your brethren from being slaughtered," and she backed off from that, "Do you realize if I do that, Mordecai, it will mean my death if I go to the king with this?" Here's what he says in verse 14. "For if you remain completely silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place, but you and your father's house will perish. Yet who knows whether you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this?" Now here's to me what is very significant. "Then Esther told them to return this answer to Mordecai. Go, gather all the Jews who are present in Shushan, and fast for me, neither eat nor drink for 3 days, day or night. My maids and I will fast likewise. And so I will go to the king, which is against the law," and here it is, "and if I perish, I perish." That's what God wants to get us to, that point right there. And are you at that point? Have you not been to that point? And maybe you are. Who knows what's been going on in your life, and you're finally saying, "Okay, I resign. Obviously, the Lord is running things and not me. I'm ready. Maybe you need to rededicate yourself to the Lord. If there's some way that we can help you in your discipleship, please come forward now as we stand and sing.